Well, this is Tom Imason, and I would like to call this public meeting of the Oregon Board of Forestry to order. This is our July 22nd, 2020 Board of Forestry meeting. I want to welcome everybody who's participating watching or involved in some other way. We are live streaming this meeting on YouTube, and oral testimony opportunity is available in real time for the decision items we have on the agenda, items 2 and 10. We want to ensure our viewers online can follow along with today's meeting. So before we start, I'll go over some familiar housekeeping tips to keep us on track. First, everyone participating or presenting, please silence your cell phones and limit background noises. Remember to use the mute feature when you are not speaking. If your video is enabled, feel free to disable if you need to step away, and don't hesitate to use the chat function on Zoom to connect with our ODF support team in Salem during the meeting. To ensure folks online can follow our board presentations with the live testimony incorporated, I'll remind everyone of our general order of operations. Generally, I will introduce the item and invite the presenters to begin. For board members, if you have clarifying questions, please use the raise hand function and I'll call on you as they come up. Presenters, we will do our best to ask questions one at a time. After presentations, the public comment period will be open to those who signed up. Commenters will be provided 3 minutes to offer testimony. Following public comment, board members may have follow-up questions for presenters, but we generally begin our discussion as a motion is proposed. Board members, we will use a roundtable approach for the voting process, which seemed to work well at our previous meetings held in this manner. Additionally, members of the public, we ask that if you would like to submit written testimony for this meeting and have it included in the record of this meeting, please send in your comments by August 5th. This will help in preparation of our board minutes. I'd also like to note that pursuant to ORS 192-6602F, the board will meet in closed executive session starting at 11:30 a.m. The purpose of this session will be to review and consider information or records that are exempt from disclosure by law. Representatives of the news media and designated staff shall be allowed to attend the executive session. This session is otherwise closed to the public. We will take a lunch break after the virtual executive session has concluded and then reconvene the public meeting at 1 p.m. Any questions about any of this? Okay, then I will perform a roll call to confirm that we have a quorum for today's items. Nils Christofferson is absent today. Cindy Deacon Williams?
Here.
Joe Justice?
Here.
Jim Kelly?
Here.
Brendan McComb?
Here.
Mike Rose?
Here.
And I'm Tom Imason. I'm here. So we do have an agenda for today's action items. Moving on to the consent agenda items, is there a motion for approval of consent items A through G?
So moved.
Second.
Cindy, you seconded?
Yes.
All right, moved and seconded. Any discussion? Then we'll vote on those items, and I'll go back through the roll call. Cindy Deacon Williams?
Aye.
Joe Justice?
Aye.
Jim Kelly?
Aye.
Brendan McComb?
Aye.
Mike Rose?
Aye.
And I'm voting aye as well, so the motions are approved. Next on our agenda is State Forester Peter Doherty for his opening comments. Peter?
Good morning. I hope you're all doing well in these challenging times. At the June meeting, I opened with a discussion on racial justice and social equity, and today I'll provide an overview of the state's response to systemic racism and inequality. Governor Brown has long championed diversity, equity, inclusion. She has increased that effort by centering the budget and policy conversation on racial justice. In June, she released the State of Oregon Equity Framework in COVID-19 Response and Recovery. She states that Oregon is at a juncture that demands our state government take proactive and anti-racist measures to build a more equitable Oregon. She also recognizes that the pandemic has further exacerbated racial disparities, citing disproportionate infection rates and other negative effects. Racial equity means closing the gap so that race can no longer predict one's success, which simultaneously improves outcomes for all. The governor defines our historically and currently underserved communities to include Oregonians who are Native American, members of Oregon's 9 federally recognized tribes, American Indians and Alaskan Natives, Black Africans and African Americans, Latinx, Hispanics, Asian, Pacific Islanders, immigrant, refugees, asylum seekers, undocumented, dreamers, linguistically diverse, people with disabilities, LGBTQ+, aging and older adults, economically disadvantaged, farm workers, migrant workers, and living in rural parts of the state. She states that we have a moral obligation to address many of the structural barriers that disproportionately impact people of colors and families navigating poverty. At our Oregon executive leadership team, we have been discussing racial justice and social equity and have expanded that lens past COVID response and recovery to all budget and policy topics. Our CEO, Katie Koba, just created for the first time a cultural change officer within Department of Administrative Services to support the governor's priority of addressing structural and institutional racism in Oregon and for DAS specifically within the enterprise of state government. Racial justice and social equity should be central to all our policies and actions. This effort will require reframing and new perspectives on board policy topics. The ODF executive team is discussing how to reframe our policy analysis in this light. One of the first topics that comes to mind is climate change. Like the pandemic, climate change is an existential problem that differentially impacts underserved communities, including people of color and low-income Oregonians. We have seen these impacts in the governor's Wildfire Council reports discussion of the differential impacts of increased wildfire smoke on lower-income Oregonians. They identified that some 40% of Oregonians rent their homes, and that status can hinder their ability to install air filtration systems. In submitting our executive order 2004 on climate change, when we submitted our report under a tight deadline, I missed a leadership opportunity to make a strong vision statement and emphasize the department's commitment to being a leader in climate adaptation and mitigation. This oversight is illustrated by yesterday's letter from the governor's office, which you all received a copy for. I have spoken to the governor's office, and I have asked our small but dedicated climate team to help me reframe our climate change vision and action plans using the lens of racial justice and social equity. We will bring this plan back to the board, and we'll use it to start the discussion of Goal G in the forestry program for Oregon. And with that, I'll pause to see if there's any questions on that topic.
Any questions from board members on this issue, comments? I don't see any, so Peter, continue, please.
Great, thanks. We had the 42nd special session in Oregon's history on June 24th and 26th. And the focus of this special session was COVID response and policing reforms. However, Senate Bill 1602 relating to forest management implemented the provisions for responsible forest management agreed to by the timber industry and the environmental groups in their MOU. And I'll come back to that a little later in my comments. We are hearing that there could another special session could be held in early August when the legislature is expected to focus on general fund shortfalls for the state budget and only a few policy bills. The Ways and Means co-chairs released their principles for rebalancing the budget for the remainder of this biennium. Their framework indicated agency program areas that would be preserved, and that included fire protection, forest practice administration, and the sudden oak death program. They released the detailed 2020 rebalance plan for agency reductions on Monday this week. Our general fund reduction is $7.1 million for a total of $8.8 million in reduction for all funds, general funds, other funds, and a little bit of federal funds. We recognize that this budget challenge is not just a 2020 problem. It's also a 2021-23 biennium problem and potentially a concern for the following biennium. As we finalize our agency request budget, which we'll discuss today, we are identifying and prioritizing for additional reductions. However, we have not received any official direction beyond the standard 10% reduction plan. The detailed legislative reduction list mostly follows the budget reduction plan we submitted to CFO in early May and discussed in June. In addition to some specific requests that we fulfilled for the legislative fiscal office. The overall reductions are one time for the remainder of the biennium, and they generally hold to our intent to prioritize people and reduce project work and service and supplies. We identified the least bad cuts that would least affect services this fire season. So some details on this. Fire protection is expected to take a $3.2 million general fund reduction for a total of $6.3 million one-time reduction through the end of the biennium. Given it's the second fiscal of the biennium, this reduction equates to a 12% decrease in fire protection for fiscal year 21. To achieve this reduction, the division will carry forward vacancy savings of permanent personnel, leverage federal dollars to offset the reduction, cut funds to rangeland fire protection associations, defer equipment and fire engine replacement, defer facility maintenance, and reduce service and supplies across all districts. This reduction could not be sustained beyond this biennium without significantly impacting our ability to provide for an adequate level of protection. Included in this reduction is a fund shift from a 50-50 split between private landowners and the general fund to a 55-45 split, which equates to a $1.9 million shift in costs to private landowners. This was not one of our reductions put forward, and I'm not quite sure how it would be implemented. Private forests is expected to take a $1.4 million general fund reduction for a total of $1.9 million one-time reduction by reducing services and supplies, eliminating the forest practice compliance audit work, additional statistical review and field data collection, reduced motor pool cost, and sudden oak death treatment activities. The division will also hold current vacant positions for 12 months in both headquarters and the field district, which equates to less forest practice administration and landowner assistance and forest health monitoring. The federal forest restoration program will realize a $359,000 reduction, or 11% of their general fund budget. It reduces funding for seasonal firefighters doing timber sale and restoration project work, and reduced funding for technical analysis and science support for local collaboratives. State Forest will forgo $195,000 of general fund for a land purchase near the Santiam State Forest. It's also important to note that approximately 1.8 million of the above reductions come out of administration. The various programs within administration would all have to carry vacancies for the rest of the biennium, resulting in less human resources, information technology, public affairs, facilities, finance, and motor pool support for the entire agencies. Reductions in administration would also impact the department's ability to implement the forthcoming recommendations from MGO, the financial consultant hired by the state to review and improve financial processes. We have been directed to accept the cuts the legislature proposed if they are the least bad cuts given the level of cuts proposed. If the cuts are not the least bad cuts, then we can offer alternative equivalent cuts. And we can only do this after consultation with our CFO and policy advisor. The Natural Resource Subcommittee of the Ways and Means is meeting today to take public testimony on these cuts. So moving on, today the Production Division will report on the current status of fire season, including COVID-19 readiness. I'm going to emphasize the work we've done to prepare for COVID-19. All aspects of our wildfire response operations have been reworked to include COVID-19 mitigation measures identifying best management practices and specific COVID protocols. We have worked closely with the state fire marshals to add capacity to our incident management teams to implement our screening, testing, contact tracing, quarantine, and isolation protocols. These COVID modules include 3 local fire service personnel who have the medical and safety expertise to mitigate the spread of COVID-19 in our fire camps. Sincere thanks to the local fire departments from all over the state who have answered the call. Almsville, Silverton, Jackson, Sheridan, Marion, Columbia River, and Silverton fire departments have all volunteered to participate in ODF's COVID modules. The Protection Division has also hired 2 limited duration personnel from the health communities. These folks will serve as technical experts in interpreting and implementing COVID-19 protocols in all aspects of our fire work. The Oregon Health Authority and county health departments have shown extraordinary leadership in helping with our COVID preparations. These partners will be part of our operations by providing a dedicated Oregon Health Authority staff member during our IMT deployments, providing a 24/7 call line for emergencies, and supporting our response to COVID cases. We expect that will be part of our new reality. I cannot thank our health partners enough as they assist us in providing for the health and safety of our firefighters. Their support is especially critical given our contract fire crews include significant number of Oregonians defined as historically and currently underserved. As I mentioned earlier, Senate Bill 1602 passed during the June special session. Signed by the governor, it became effective on July 7th. There was very strong support in the legislature for this landmark bill. It includes several significant changes to protection requirements for non-federal forest, and the department is very excited about this strong collaborative effort for developing long-term solutions for Oregon's forest. Highlights include mediation sessions for developing an approach to evaluate and jointly recommend substantive and procedural changes to the Oregon Forest Practice Act. The governor's office will lead these sessions over the next 18 months with representatives of forest industry and environmental interests. Language about aerial application of pesticide by helicopters that increase riparian buffers along certain streams and buffers near homes and schools. These requirements go into effect January 1 of 2021. Language about providing real-time announcement to nearby residents and water users within certain distance of aerial application by helicopter. These requirements are likely to go into effect July 1, 2021. And it also directs the board to adopt permanent rules in the Siskiyou Georegion, similar to those in place in Western Oregon for salmon, steelhead, and bull trout streams. These rules will go into effect January 2021. And you folks just approved the starting of that permanent rulemaking, so we appreciate that. The bill provides funding and position authority, about $840,000 for the current biennium, with $740,000 dedicated to building the real-time announcement functionality. The department will receive 0.84 FTE this biennium and 1.25 FTE in the 2021 biennium to support the additional protection requirements. The division put together a six-person project implementation team with Josh Bernard, Deputy Chief of Private Forests, as a project lead. The existing workload in private forests will be impacted as these folks focus on implementing Senate Bill 1602 over the next 6 months. The budget reductions in vacant positions, if they go into effect, have significantly altered the division's capacity. The division is currently planning necessary mid-course adjustments to their board work plan to be discussed at the October retreat. While this change is a shift in work duties for some folks, and other folks will be tapped to pick up the key projects in the interim, the department remains excited and committed to advancing the collaborative effort. On kind of just a quick budget update around our fire finance. On July 15th, we received our fully signed and executed one-year loan agreement with the state treasury for $55 million. This money is now available to the department when we determine it is needed and can be accessed within days of notifying the state treasurer. Given that we have to draw the entire amount at once and we'll be paying 2% of interest on the amount until repaid, we will be strategizing on the best timing for initiating the request, factoring in our financial conditions and the fires that are on our landscape. With this loan, and we have roughly $30 million cash on hand and another $15 million on its way from FEMA, we have positioned ourselves to at least enter fire season with some level of insurance that we can manage the financial burden of large fire. While the loan doesn't fix the structural problem we've been trying to address, we're in a much more comfortable position than we were just a month ago. Please note that while these resources are significant in our ability to manage the 2020 fire season, they no way put the agency on solid financial footing. The department will continue to engage in substantial efforts to ensure we're able to meet our obligations to repay the outstanding balance of the loan when the time comes. Cost containment measures that we implemented are still in effect, and we'll keep them in effect to maximize our ability to respond to all the pressure on our financial resources. And I'm going to sort of wrap up with some miscellaneous highlights and accomplishments to try to end on a positive note. Our seed orchard, the J.E. Schroeder Sea Orchard, is anticipating its largest harvest ever, estimated to be 800 bushels, whatever those are, or 2,640 pounds of Douglas fir seedlings. That equates to about 30 to 40 million seedlings, enough to plant about 80,000 acres of land. The overall increase in final timber harvest yields due to tree improvement is about 30% per acre on these seedlings. We have a new natural resource, a new agreement with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, or NRCS. We have a long-standing cooperative relation to provide technical and financial assistance to family forest landowners. We use it to implement a suite of practices designed to improve forest health. With no dedicated state funding for family forest lands, this partnership has been a critical tool in our toolbox. We combine it with our other state and private forestry grant programs and our federal forest restoration program. And with that, we're able to address forest health, fire and fuels management, and water quality at the landscape scale. The new agreement extends our partnership for another 5 years, doubles technical assistance funding to $2 million, and broadens the scope of allowable activities, paving the way for more local innovation in the delivery of technical and financial service. And the final note is baseball starts tomorrow. So return of America's pastime. So thank you, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions for Peter? All right, seeing none, we'll continue to our next agenda item.